This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, I'm Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, action, exploitation, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1970s to today. Be sure and check out reallyawfulmovies.com for reviews, interviews, lists, and terrific movie giveaways.
From our temporary digs in London, Ontario, Canada, at Shockstock, this is a special edition of the Really Awful Movies podcast. So, Shockstock. Excellent up-and-coming horror aficionado festival.
Yeah. I believe this is the fifth year here in beautiful London.
Yeah.
This is the London, Ontario.
Yeah, it's like a college town. It's really, you know, 300,000 people. It's really dominated basically by Western University. And
yep.
You know, there's just campus pubs galore, so that's, we're a little out of our element, but at the same time, not so much.
No. I think we're
bars, yeah, that, yeah. Campus bars.
A lot of bars. And speaking of which, we're both a little worse for wear this morning.
Because
this is the morning of day two. We're getting ready to hit the venue, hit the convention. But yeah, there was a bit of a party in the hotel last night. There was a bit of a, it was interesting. It was good. It was fun.
Yeah, and you know, not to name drop or anything, but we're
rubbing shoulders,
and maybe not literally because he's a very tall guy, but with Edwin Neal.
Edwin Neal, the hitchhiker from
Chainsaw Massacre, which is really exciting. So we just came back from, having a restorative, giant greasy spoon breakfast to try and, you know, allay some of our, you know, excesses from last night.
Indeed,
and there's two people in the diner. They had these excellent, excellent Warriors hoodies.
Handmade
with all the gangs represented, from the, you know, Gramercy Riffs to the, you know, the
Baseball Furies,
yeah, and the Orphans, everybody represented.
Yep, everything in between.
Yeah, so super cool, and that speaks to the, I guess that's the underlying theme here. It's just been great to talk.
And he was sitting with somebody wearing a Dr. Butcher MD shirt, somebody in the lobby was wearing a Contagion shirt. I mean, and all moves are represented on people's chests, you know.
So two video dead shirts so far. So just all of our favorites represented.
Yep, I was wearing my Phantom of the Paradise shirt yesterday, and, the biggest fashion faux pas that any, somebody else was wearing the exact same shirt, my Death Records shirt, but anyway, whatever. Everyone's cool, we're having a great time.
Yeah, for sure.
And we're looking forward to day two, and, more shock-stalking, more partying, and,
more
chatting.
Yeah. Just gotta recover.
And,
the venue's interesting. Then sort of, how would you describe Centennial Hall?
It's a community center.
Yeah, it's really odd. Sort of an odd. Yeah, it looks like the kind of one of these halls that might hold a wedding, but it's a little bit more downmarket than that. So it's sort of a weird sort of banquet type hall. But it seems like they would sell used books there or have, like, I don't know, knitting fairs there or something. It's a kind of, it's a great kind of venue in a basement. So it's
very, very, very apropos for Shockstock.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Shockstock is it's put on by James and Jake from Vagrancy Cinema, and they're self-appointed scumbags. You know, so yeah, it's a good scumbag venue, and this is a fun fest, and again, great people. So
yeah, it was cool. The guy from Goblin is there drinking at the after party.
Yeah,
and
Maurizio was there. Yep.
Yeah. And
Neil popped in, and Jonathan Thurston popped in, and Tony Todd. I don't think he made an appearance at the after party. Although I did ride an elevator with him, so that was good. And
it's interesting to host a after party in the hotel, but not in like a conference room in the basement away from it. This was on the 12th floor, and we're pretty sure we annoyed everyone within earshot, which would have been everyone in this hotel for the most part. So yeah, I don't know if when it closed down, but we got ourselves out of there at probably a decent hour, so we could at least be semi-functional today. It's not saying much. I overheard someone at the party say, it might have been at the party, say that this is better than Cleveland. So I forget what the Cleveland Horror Fest is called. We have yet to check that one out, but we hear good things about that too. But they said this one has a little more variety and a little more accessible. So anyway.
Yeah. And then there's also the official Sharkstock after party tonight. So we definitely have to recover for that.
Yeah.
So, and we'll be bringing you our recollections after the after party.
Yeah, if there are any.
If there are any, indeed.
And we'll talk to you soon.
So I'm here at Shockstop sitting with the incredible Tony Todd, star of Candyman, Night of the Living Dead, Godless Nation, Hatchet 1, 2, Wishmaster, the pro, tons of voice work. You played Darkseid in
Lego, Justice League of America, Bizarro World.
Yeah,
you did. One of the fun gigs I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, all I had to do was go, rush them. You know? I mean, Darkseid is unbeatable.
You also did voice work for Transformers, Injustice, Call of Duty. But this is Shockstock, so people want to know about Candyman.
Oh, you can ask me whatever they want to know. I don't bite. I'm good. I'm happy. I'm content.
Well, you know, before we talk about Candyman, I saw you in the telephone show Hollister, and you're playing yourself.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And you were absolutely hilarious. You were delightful. You seem to have a really good sense of humor.
I do. I love life. I have two children who are well accomplished, the best thing I could ever have done in my career. My daughter is getting ready to graduate from graduate school at Columbia University, and she's been chosen the commencement speaker for her class. You know what an honor that is?
That
makes me smile, not only outside, but on the inside. You know, and she gets out with relatively little debt because of what I did, which is a major accomplishment.
Well, props to your daughter.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. Fist bump.
Yes. But for such a man who's so full of life, I mean, how do you reconcile this with playing such dark roles?
Not all of them are dark.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them are dark. I come from the theater.
Right.
So I've been able to play a lot of classical roles. Right now, I'm working on a one-man show called Ghost in the House, which is about the legendary Jack Johnson, who was the first African-American heavyweight champion in the world. And we've been touring around the country, just did a show in Pennsylvania, and we're gearing up for this huge show in LA, California, the UCLA Black Alumni Association, which is going to get us into all the colleges, hopefully in all across North America, not just America, North America. This is a show that must be told. And ultimately, that's going to Broadway. So that keeps me relevant, and it's my first love. It's what got me into this whole crazy paramedic business in the first place. And I have to keep, you always have to respect and honor and return to your first love. So that keeps everything in balance.
Because, I mean, last trip on MDB, you have 183 credits. I mean, you've been on TV shows as diverse as Smallville, Young and the Restless, CSI, Star Trek. I mean,
Beverly Hills, 90210.
Yeah, I mean, you've been all over the place.
Yeah. And then some cool shit, Criminal Minds, X-Files.
But you're indelibly linked to Candyman.
It seems that way.
Yeah.
And I was told when I got that role, Bernard Rose, the director, told me, we hung out for a week in Chicago before we started shooting, and I'm a blues fan, as is he, and we're sitting at the legendary Kingston Mine, owned by a good friend of mine, Frank Pellegrino. And I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to wait for Buddy Guy to come on, who apparently allegedly was coming here soon. I'm going to miss him. And he says, Tony, you know this is going to change your life. I said, well, Bernard, I can't think like that. I just want to do a good job. I just want to make it good. When I read it and when I saw, a story that's a script that's based on a story by Clive Barker, and this character and this one scene with the bees just come out of his mouth, and I knew I had the same feeling that I would imagine Bela Lugosi had when he first read the middle sequence of Dracula. And he said, this is going to be something that will be forever burned into the minds of cinematic fans.
So you had an idea that this would be something?
Well, I knew it was out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
I knew it was, I didn't know how long it would last. I mean, not a single day goes by, whether I'm at a convention or not. Whether I'm at the airport last night going through customs, a customs officer said, I wish I could take a selfie with you. I'm supposed to be checking for terrorists.
Did he call you Candyman?
Yeah, he whispered it. And he was actually more impressed by Ben and Night of the Living Dead. But I said, whatever floats your boat.
Well, that's I want to talk to you about that as well. I mean, you played the character of Ben in the Night of the Living Dead remake.
Originated by the great Dwayne Jones.
Yes, and that role for an African-American actor was absolutely groundbreaking.
It was. That's what convinced me. I remember seeing that in a drive-in, back when we had drive-ins. Because a drive-in for a good film, particularly a horror film, is the best place to see it. You're trapped in your vehicle with someone that you hopefully love, and this shit is happening. And the original black and white was perfect for the drive-in. Black and white, it was like a documentary unfolding in front of your eyes. And seeing what Dwayne Jones did convinced me that I knew I wanted to be an actor, but I wasn't sure about the business plan. Because unfortunately, African Americans are not necessarily the first to be chosen. But he convinced me that you could carry a film, you could be recognized. Because the major thing about the original, it wasn't his being black was never mentioned. It wasn't the forefront. He was just a person.
Nothing was made out of it. Romero said in an interview the role was originally for a white person. Mm-hmm. When they cast Dwayne Jones,
because he was the best one they came along. So,
what was it like working with Tom Savini as a director?
Tom Savini is a magician, and I say that with all respect because I'm an amateur magician. And
I used to be.
I just went to the Magic Castle last week for a bachelor party.
Right,
and we had a seance in the Houdini room, you know, but I was fucking with the guy a little bit, so he said, you know, misdirection is everything, isn't it? And he didn't like that. I wasn't explaining how it was done, but I just let him know.
Then
he tried to tell me, don't be careful if somebody like blows in your hair. I said, well, now that you told me, I'm ready.
Right.
But have you ever been to Magic Castle?
I have not.
You got to put it on your bucket list, man.
Yeah.
It is an amazing building. It's dedicated to the art of magic. Mm-hmm. You walk in, you have to talk to the art owl and say open sesame before you can even get in through the bookcase.
Right.
Then there's Artemis, the magical owl, which you can ask a yes or no question, and it is surprising in the eerie how accurate it is. Then they have a player's piano where you can name any tune in the world, as obscure as you think, and it automatically plays it without hesitation. So that's just the beginning. Then you got all these old-time magicians hanging out at the bar, everywhere, just practicing their sleight of hand.
And of course, Guy Vernon he made that place famous. I mean, that was like home for a while.
Dude. Karloff went there. It's Vincent Price. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's legendary. They got me. I was waiting for my friends to join. I'm sitting at a stool at the bar. And like ordered my little cognac, and I'm waiting, and I didn't notice until my friend showed up that the perspective was wrong. Mm-hmm. That all of a sudden the chair had shrunk, and apparently it shrunk like a foot every like 10 seconds, and he got me. The bartender got me, and I'm like a little baby in kindergarten.
I mean, you're a big guy.
I know. I didn't notice it until they showed up, because I know my elbows kept going. Where the fuck is the bar? So little things like that. That if you're a true fan of magic,
right,
which is similar to cinema,
yeah, for sure,
that's the place.
It's all about illusion, making people believe what isn't. I don't want to take too much of your time up. I did want to ask you though. I mean, do you find the younger fans recognizing more for your roles in Candyman or Final Destination?
Well, the real young ones know it from Bizarro World.
And yeah.
Which is good. I keep stretching generations.
Yeah.
I mean, the 20-year-olds know Final Destination, I suppose. I got something for everybody. The older women like Young and the Restless.
Right.
Which I did because my aunt who raised me, that was her favorite show, and they offered something for me, and it was an interesting story arc. Mm-hmm.
And
tough challenge though, because they send you the script the night before, and you get one shot, one take.
But that must be good preparation for it. Almost like a boot camp for actors. You know,
absolutely.
A lot of actors start out with soap operas.
My first gig was on a soap opera, and I got fired because I had just gotten my master's in theater, and I was asking questions that I guess they didn't have time to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who am I? Where am I? Where am I going? What do I want? What is my relationship to the world? They didn't want that.
It's
a soap opera, pal.
Besides your stature, I mean, I know that your trademark is your voice, and you mentioned doing a lot of voiceover work and being known for Bizarro. How does voiceover work compare to actual acting, physical acting?
It's isolated, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge of voiceover work, I go in a lot. Sometimes I get offered shit, but it's a very tricky thing because you have to, if it's for a product or device, They want you to be recognizable, but not too recognizable.
Right.
They want the thing to be the thing. So sometimes I don't book as many as perhaps I should, because I just try to lay it down. But I'm learning how to dial it back and just let whatever it is I'm doing speak for itself.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for your time, Tony. I don't want to take too much of it.
I gotta give a plug to me and Bernard Rose rejoining and rehooking up for this wonderful production, Frankenstein, that I told you about earlier, that just debuted at the Brussels International Film Festival.
Yeah.
I saw you followed me on Twitter, stalker.
Yep.
So go on there and you'll see the review.
Yep.
It's amazing.
And you mentioned it won a bunch of awards.
The top award, the Golden Raven.
Looking forward to it.
We just got picked up by Alchemy Films. It's going to have a U.S. distribution, and you know, which is rare these days for a horror film that's not about a doll, or you know, possession, or paranormal stuff. You know, so it's. I think it'll. And Bernard and I hit magic before, and I think we're going to hit it again.
Excellent.
And then we got The Ghost in the House, and I did a film earlier this year called Cold Descent with the great Canadian actor Michael Eklund. He and I, as these Western desperados stuck on a train that's supernaturally taking us to places that we have no idea where we're going. So, and that was directed by a 22-year-old who, when I have my interview with him or my meeting, I always like to talk to my directors before we shoot. And I said, where'd you go to school? And he told me Wesley. I said, well, yeah. Turns out he went to undergrad with my daughter. So I walked out of there thinking, oh my God, it's full circle. I'm being directed by someone my daughter's age. But I have faith.
Yeah.
And it worked out okay. So.
And when can we look forward to seeing that?
Huh?
When can we look forward to seeing that?
Well, we shot it in January, so they're doing what they do now. I don't have any official word on it, but it will come out.
Yeah.
Lance Henriksen is in it, myself, Michael Ed.
Lance Henriksen?
Yeah.
Wow.
He plays... someone who's friends with the conductor.
We're big fans of Lance Henriksen.
Oh, he's great. Great guy. Great. This is our second film together.
He's a great guy, and you're a great guy. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. So.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Yeah, you once said that if you saw Tobe Hooper, you'd kill him. Do you still feel that way?
But you got to understand what the context of that was.
Right, right.
When you're doing an interview, you go, oh, well, because he owes me a lot of money, he didn't pay. If I ever see Tobe Hooper again, I'm going to kill him. Which you do in a voice, right? A silly voice, and then you go, just kidding. And then you go on with the interview. When they print the interview, they take that part out and put it this big in headlights. If I ever see Tobe Hooper again, I'm going to kill him. Hitchhiker vows death to Hooper. No, seriously, for real. They don't print the part where you say, oh, just kidding. Uh-uh. And then you got to spend the next 30 years explaining it. That's for real.
Yeah.
And now Toby's like, he won't even come to the same town I'm in, let alone the same show. He would never do a show. He's never done a show with me.
Yeah.
He's gonna kill me, man. It's silly.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't do it.
Yep.
But yeah, because then they say, did you see her? Well, it's a yes or no question. You know how they do it. It's a yes or no question. Did you see her? Yeah, but did you say it? And you have to say, yes. Because I said it. I also said, yeah. Well, cut, we're done.
And exactly. Go,
so in the subsequent interviews, they do the same thing. Did you say it? Right, you said it. Hitchhiker vows said he said it.
And it's what's your words again.
Yep.
I mean, and it starts all over again.
Yeah.
I also used to joke that I would have whacked them already, except my six children asked me not to. And the reason they asked me not to is because they said, Daddy, they know it's you. It's probably true.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay. So then I jokingly said, he doesn't even know he's still alive because of these six people that he doesn't even know. He's living because of them. And he doesn't even know. And I was doing it in a comical way. Hitchhiker says family saves Hooper. Did you say it or didn't you? Well, yeah, but it was in a voice. Did you say it or didn't you?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's funny stuff.
Thank you.
It's a good money.
Yeah. How much?
All right, so I'm sitting here with Giovanni Lombardi Radice, or John Morgan, as he is also known, famous for movies such as City of Living Dead, Cannibal Ferox, Cannibal Apocalypse, Stage Fright, House on the Edge of the Park, Gangs of New York. Good to chat with you. I think our listeners are very happy to hear from you. To begin, one of my favorite films that you're in is Stage Fright. I think it's an underrated masterpiece. What was it like working on that film?
It's a pretty nice movie, and I liked pretty much for two reasons. One, because it was the first one directed by my old buddy, Michele Suave.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
And we have been great friends all our lives. It started on the set of the Fulci movie, City of the Living Dead. We met there, and we have been friends ever since. So I was thrilled to be in his first movie. I was sure he's gonna demonstrate to be a great director, as he did. And second thing, I had one of my few comedy roles, because in the cost context of a horror movie, my role was a comedy role.
Right.
The gay dancer always bitching and
you played Brett, the
making fun of everybody, and so it was a comedy role, and I'm a very good comic actor, and each time I have an occasion to show it, I grab.
Now, of course, you're famous for working with Lucio Fulci on City of the Living Dead, one of the most, memorable death scenes of all time, with the drill to the head. What was it like working with Lucio Fulci?
Lucio Fulci had a terrible fame of a shouting person, mistreating actors, so people had told me, you'll have a terrible time and whatever. On the contrary, to me, he was always very kind, very polite, very respectful of the fact that I was coming from a theater milieu, and so I had not the smallest problem with him. It was true, he was shouting a lot, but mainly he was shouting at the production not to to let them get sloppy, or you know, he had a theory that on set people must be always on the verge, so he was also at times shouting out of nothing, just acting the shouting director. I mean, but deep in his heart, I think he was a very nice man, and he surely was very nice to me.
Well, I mean, Lucio is a cool artist, and he's missed terribly. Now, of course, it was common practice for actors in Italian cinema to represent to anglicize their names, i.e. Lucio Fulci was Louis Fuller. You were John Morgan. How did you choose that name?
Because I was asked to, at a point, I don't remember when, maybe for Cannibal Apocalypse, or, you know, it was fashionable those times in Italy to let those films pass for Americans. So everybody was asked to select a foreign name. Now, I didn't like in the least the idea of having a name who didn't mean anything to me. So I just selected, well, of course, John translated Giovanni, and Morgan is the maiden name of my maternal grandmother. So it meant something to me. I think it had a nice sound, Morgan. Reminded of Morgan the pirate. So I thought that John Morgan was a good one. So.
Now, you're known for taking a tremendous amount of punishment in a lot of your early movies and often meeting your demise. How did that come about? I mean, that you're always... You rarely live to see the end credits in these movies.
Pardon?
You're known for taking a lot of punishment, for your death scenes, for dying.
Yes. I don't know. I think that when I was younger, I had something that tickled to the saddest things in directors. I don't know, I was very frail, very pale, very... I don't know. Surely I'm not a sadistic myself. But I think that I had that something that could make me the perennial victim.
Now, I read somewhere, correct me if I'm wrong, that you regret playing Mike Logan in Cabin Fever.
Yeah. I loathe the movie.
Yeah.
It's a creepy piece of shit.
Thank you so much for your time, and it's been an absolute pleasure.
Okay.
Alright, so now I'm talking with Shotzi Blackheart, who's one of the contestants in the running for Miss Shockstock.
Yes.
And tell me, why do you want to become Miss Shockstock?
I am the biggest horror movie fan out of all of them, I would like to say. I am on a local horror television show in San Francisco, California. And
that's where you're from, right? San Francisco.
Yes, I'm from San Francisco, and I've just always loved horror movies. I love the classic. My favorite movie is The Last Man on Earth. So, yes, I love Vincent Price.
I worship Vincent Price.
Don't we all?
I think so. Yeah.
Like, if, totally.
I have two Vincent Price tattoos.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Sure, I got the there's one right there, and I got Dr. Fives up there.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm working my way to getting a Vincent Price tattoo. I just, like, really need to... You don't also have fucking a Ramones tattoo, do you?
Shall we?
The Ramones is the greatest rock and roll man in history.
In history, I agree.
In history.
Yep.
Yeah.
And this, I just got this. This is like the Ramones logo, but sort of like in a sort of...
Oh, wow, that's really cool.
Deconstructed way, yeah.
That's a really good idea.
I fucking love the Ramones.
Like, you wouldn't kill me if I stole that idea.
No, not at all.
No? Like, if we were tattoo buddies?
We could be tattoo buddies.
That's really cool. Okay. I see what you're doing.
So, favorite Vincent Price film, Last Man on Earth?
Yes, yes.
What is it about Last Man on Earth?
Just everything about it. I like the kind of, you don't know if they're vampire zombie things. It's eerie.
Yep.
It's in black and white.
Yep.
I like my black and white films. It's just solid, good. There's not a lot of dialogue. It's just visually pleasing.
Vince, he's very understated in that movie, you know, compared to like other movies that he's in, where it's a bit more kind of campy, a bit more.
Yeah.
Great, great performance. And what's your favorite Ramones song? I know that's a very hard question to ask.
Rockaway Beach.
Rockaway Beach?
Rockaway Beach.
Awesome.
Has to be, yep.
Alright, so getting back to being Miss Shockstock, so you're here in London.
Yes.
You having a good time?
I am having a blast.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Shockstock guys show you a good time, so. It's a party atmosphere, definitely. I've been to many horror conventions, but this has to be, hands down, the most partying horror convention.
Awesome. So we were talking earlier, and you were saying you're an independent wrestler.
Yes!
How long have you been in that for?
I've been wrestling for 2 years, about. I train in the hood of Oakland, California. There's, like, every time I walk into training, there's a bunch of syringes all over the floor. So, it's fun. It's a smoky, dingy warehouse. Everyone's big stoners there. We're kind of the misfit toys of wrestling schools. No one really believes that we produce any good wrestlers, but... You know what? I'm out there and I'm kicking ass. So
now, do you wrestle? When you train, do you wrestle men? Do you wrestle women? Do you wrestle both?
I mostly wrestle men because there's more men in wrestling.
Right.
There's about 5 chick wrestlers in NorCal, and so I pretty much wrestle the same 2 chicks every show.
Right.
So yeah, I have to wrestle men.
And if you had to describe your gimmick, what would that be?
Well, I am a stoner cheerleader that goes to Stoner University. I did not pick this gimmick. It just kind of happened.
Right.
I have 2 gimmicks, and then I'm also, like, very American patriotic. I come out with, like, a cowboy hat and a getup that's Americana. And I'm metal.
And you're metal. So you're a stoner cheerleader, you're patriotic, yes. And you're metal.
Yes.
So three gimmicks.
Well, the patriotic metal gimmick.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and then the cheerleader is like a stoner cheerleader for Stoner University. So I'm Missy High as shit.
That's good.
A spin-off of Missy Hyatt.
I'm kind of betraying my age. I remember Missy Hyatt.
Yes, you know? Okay,
she was,
right.
She was hot. I mean, back in the day.
She was. She definitely was.
Not so much nowadays. But, yeah, she was. Yeah. I think she's recently got arrested for something or another. I don't know.
I actually have her on Facebook, and I've been stalking her a little bit because I want to see what she was up to now. But, yeah, she's definitely not the little slutty announcer that we remember.
That's a very clever name, actually.
Right? No one really gets the reference, but yeah, Missy High as shit.
So, I mean, everybody, when I was a kid, it was real to me, you know what I mean?
Right?
Everybody nowadays knows that it's not.
Yeah, kayfabe has definitely broken.
Exactly. But, I mean, the reality is that you guys go through so much abuse in the ring, you know, to entertain
this
fans.
This is true.
I mean, regardless of the fact, you know, it's real, it's fake, it doesn't matter. You guys put your body through so much shit, so much.
Oh, yeah, my back is messed up.
Yeah?
Like, it's always hurting. I have to wear leggings or stockings all the time because my legs are completely bruised.
Have you suffered any injuries in the ring?
No.
Okay. Let's keep that way.
But I mean, people around me do all the time. Like, I get bloody noses all the time. I get hit in the face really hard. It's real. I mean,
it's real.
It's real.
Yeah. It's predetermined, but it's real.
Yeah. I mean, it's planned out, but it hurts like a motherfucker.
Yeah. Watching many, many wrestling documentaries about indie wrestling, you know, all these wrestlers who are, you know, putting their bodies through, like, the ringer, getting, like, you know, smacked in the head with chairs.
Yeah.
And they're doing it for, like, you know, $5, $10, $15.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about, like, wrestling that, you know, makes you want to put your body through that?
Man, you know, that's a good fucking question because, I mean, I love it. Like, being in the ring, there's so much adrenaline going on. You don't feel the pain. It's, I feel like I'm in a playground as, like, a kid and just fucking shit up. I just feel really badass and cutting promos and talking shit. It's a lot of fun. The pain comes with it.
I was going to say, you probably feel the pain afterwards.
Yes, the pain comes afterwards, but in the moment, I feel like a rock star.
That's awesome. So if you had to name three wrestlers who inspired you, or you want to aspire to be.
Okay.
Male, female, doesn't matter.
I love the old school guys. I'm a big Ricky Steamboat fan.
Awesome, yeah. Very technical.
Yes. The way he moves in the ring. Rowdy Piper. Don't kill me for this. The Rock. He's amazing on the fucking mic.
The Rock is probably the most charismatic wrestler of all time.
Right? I pride myself on my promos and, like, him and, like, if you took, like, his promos and Macho Man's and, like, Rowdy Piper's is, like, what, like, I strive to sound like. You know, just fucking out there and ridiculous. You don't hear that anymore.
No, you don't. That's what wrestling lacks now.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen The Rock live a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the way the guy can have the crowd in the palm of his hand, like, it's just insane. Like,
right? Just, like, they just feed off
exactly.
It. It's amazing to witness it.
And he can get the crowd through anything. So.
He's so mainstream, but I fucking love The Rock.
No, like,
I love him.
I even like his movies. I don't know. What say,
yeah, right?
I like The Rock. So, well, I wish you all the best in the Miss Shockstar competition and also in your future wrestling. Oh, before we go, you're also doing a little acting, right?
Mm-hmm. I do, you know, some B-movie indie films local in California. So I just did Forgotten Tales and Doll Murder Spree. They're both slasher films.
Films alike?
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Blood, lots of blood. Moses J. Mosley was in the Doll Murder Spree one. He was one of Michonne's zombies in Walking Dead. So that's fun.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to speak with Ron Mackey, who is a traumatic non-parallel. I mean, he's one of the top traumatics. And when I had the pleasure of interviewing Lloyd Kaufman, we talked about Ron, and we talked about the fans of Troma and why they're so dedicated. And Lloyd mentioned you by name. He said you basically are the one that sort of takes care of the, you know, Canada, Western New York region, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I'm a traumatic true and true. I've been a fan of Troma for well over 20 years.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing, loving what I'm loving, you know, if not for Troma.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, what was your first experience with Troma?
Oh, geez. Back in probably late 80s, renting movies, they had the coolest posters in the video stores. So I rented Surf Nazis Must Die, had the coolest poster. I remember that one, Toxic Avenger, Rabid Grannies, that kind of stuff, Class of Nukem High. They had the coolest posters, and probably around 1990, early 1991, as an extra on one of the VHSs, or either that or an HBO special, one of those, I saw a behind the scenes from Troma. I think it was an HBO special talking about Troma that was all about how Troma operated, how the company worked, how they used all these people to work on their movies and stuff. I thought, this is the coolest company. That's what I want to do. I want to do, like, special effects. I want to work with this company. I want to do anything with them. And I thought, that'd be the coolest thing in my life to do. And then, you know, real life came on. I went back to school. I worked, you know, I managed restaurants. I moved to Western New York from California and moved to a small town in New York and never heard about Troma again for 15 years. This little town didn't have Troma movies in the video stores. Never heard about them again until 2005 when they were filming Poltergeist. My wife saw it online that they were filming in Buffalo, just an hour and a half from me. And she's like, they're looking for volunteers or actors to be extras. I'm like, oh, well, what the heck? She goes, if you like that stuff, you ought to go volunteer. Or I'll see if they can use somebody. Hey, what the heck? Okay, so I dragged her along with me, went up and got a little part being an extra in Poltergeist. And that kept growing into more and more stuff. I did a little extra work on there and more extra work. Then that grew into more stuff. Lloyd got us to volunteer at a film festival and then a convention after that. And I'm like, oh, conventions are cool. I thought only Star Trek had conventions. I'd never heard of these before. I didn't know there were film conventions. So I volunteered at another one. I'm like, this is friggin' awesome. These are fun. And I was working for New York State at the time, so I had lots of vacation time. It's like, okay, I can do this. I have tons of vacation time. So I kept taking off more time and doing more conventions. And about that time, Lloyd had an opening at the office where they just let the only person that really did conventions go. And so at the next show I did, he just pestered me all weekend long. He's like, you know, you should do this all the time for us. Why don't you be the convention manager and do, like, all the conventions that you can go to and manage all the other ones? And, no, I have a real job. I work for the state. I don't have time to do this. I have a life. I can't do it. You know, and he didn't let up all weekend long. He just hammered at me. Why don't you do this anyway? You do a great job. Keep doing it.
He was persistent.
He was very persistent. So eventually I'm like, all right, I'm sure I can do something. We'll throw this together. So instead of doing, like, you know, 6 to 7 of these a year, after a couple of years, it grew into me doing 25 of these shows a year. So every other week of the year, I was somewhere on the road. And, you know, we slowed down a little bit now. That seems like conventions sort of peaked, and they, you know, now we were starting to get a little more selective in the ones we were doing. So we've slowed down a little bit on it, but and now we have some really good people. We've had them for quite a few years now, doing them on the West Coast and down in the Florida area, that have been doing them for years first down there too. They do a few each year in each one of those areas. But we try to coordinate a few of them, quite a few of them, from anywhere from the Midwest to the East Coast ourselves. But it's a lot of fun.
So it's funny you say about for many years you had to find it funny for my movies, right? Because when I got into Troma, it was the same sort of thing. Like, I had to search. I mean, it was like, I couldn't just go down my local Blockbuster and rent, you know,
right,
Terra Firma, Toxic Avenger, plus like the Freaks, whatever. So you had to really, so I mean, I think that sort of dedication towards finding these movies to come out, like, it created from Army, mm-hmm. which I'm proud to say I'm part of, as you are as well. So, I mean, you mentioned the coolest posters, but what else is it about the films that you just really respond to?
It's just a lot of fun. I mean, yeah. You know, a lot of them, you know, they are great movies. And they're not going to win awards, but they're just fun.
Well, they're all good movies. I mean, Poltergeist is one of the most incisive satires I've seen.
I mean, the stuff that Lloyd does himself, I like because he clearly has a message he wants to put across with him. And I really love that about him. And I learned it even more watching him make a movie. When the first time I was on Poltergeist. I mean, he's such a zany guy that you would think that, you know, he's a zany guy. He does these low-budget movies. You think, you know, he just gets lucky. But, you know, it's great that they actually turn out that there's something people like. Until you watch him make it, and he's dead serious about what he's making. When he puts a camera on his shoulder, he's totally serious about what he's doing. It's not just this zany guy who gets lucky and they turn out. He has a plan, and he knows what he's doing when he's doing it. He's not, I mean, lucky by any means. He's dead serious about what he wants, and if it doesn't work out that way, he's very pissed off about it.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
But as soon as he yells cut, I mean, he's the first guy over there patting me on the back and saying, you know, sorry I was yelling, you know, you did a great job, that's great, thanks so much for this, you did great, so happy. But he's dead serious about what he wants, and I really respect that out of him. You know, he's a great guy.
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah, I'm a way bigger Lloyd fan, I think, than I am a lot of the movies that we put out.
Sometimes, you know,
I really like what he does for independent art.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, Lloyd is the, like, we call him, like, it's funny because, I mean, Roger Corman sort of is still alive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but Lloyd is the Roger Corman of his day. Even
oh, yeah. And he's a big Roger Corman fan, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a big inspiration to Lloyd when he started.
Yep. So, Ron, thank you so much for talking to us.
Sure.
But before I let you go, top three Troma movies.
Top three Tromas? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got to be Toxic Avenger just because that's incredible. And, I mean, it's not a Lloyd one, but Cannibal the Musical is just, I mean, I think for no other reason that's the easiest foray for anybody who doesn't know Troma films to move into them. And then, I mean, I hate to jump on the bandwagon for a new, you know, Lloyd's newest film, but I think Return to Nukem High is, it's just so incredible. It's, you know, his newest one, but I think it's probably, I think he gets better with almost every movie he does.
Yeah.
And that one's just such a jump ahead that I love it.
And I can't wait for part two.
I know, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, well, thanks so much, right, Ron.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. Or not.
All right, so now I'm here with another contestant from the Chop Stop. This is Starlet Razor, and you're a local girl.
Kind of, yeah. Like, I'm from Sudbury, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm the only Canadian in the Miss Chop Stop competition, which is fun. Yeah, it's my first time being in London, so I'm really excited about it.
Have you had a chance to walk around London?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm actually really surprised about how great the food is here. I wasn't expecting such a selection. Sudbury doesn't really have that, like, local, exotic feel to it. So I've been exploring all of the, like, new foods.
The culinary...
Yeah, I'm a big food lover, so I'm all up in that.
So, why do you want to be Miss Chop Stop?
It's just a new opportunity. I feel like it's going to be a good networking experience, and that's pretty much it. Like, it's just a new cool thing to do, and to branch out to a different brand of people. I'm a burlesque dancer on a normal day, so this is really, like, new and different for me. It's my first convention, so that's really fun. So that's pretty much it. It's just that I want to just be here to get the experience and do something new and different.
Now, you mentioned that you've acted in some independent films.
Yep, I'm getting ready to do something called Sleepwalking with Distanfield Production. He was actually here last year, and they did some stuff for his last feature called Black Forest. And then Sudbury has a horror comedy coming up with a vampire thing called THC Plus. So I'm sure that part of Sudbury Burlesque and myself will be part of that feature film that they're coming up with.
And I asked one of your competitors what her favorite horror film is, and she said the last one I'm going to start with surprise. What would your favorite horror film be?
Mine is pretty much all the Chucky series, just because it's very nostalgic for me. Like, I grew up watching them, and I just love the idea of it. I'm also a pretty big fan of, like, anything with, like, possession films. Like, I found, like, a new genre of things that I really love. I love things with a backstory, and that's, like, really creepy, and, like, anything could happen to you, you know? So I don't, like, really have, like, a huge, like, favorite yet for, like, possession films, but I really do love the whole genre. And I'm a big fan of, like, vintage, like, Scream Queens and things like that. Like, all of my fashion and all of my burlesque routines are really dark and based off of, like, vintage Scream Queens. So.
Such as?
Vampyra, Elvira, like, Morticia. I actually do a Wednesday Addams routine where I, like, morph into Morticia after. So, yeah, I've always been, like, inspired by that kind of, like, dark, classic beauty.
Is your act ever toured to Toronto, or?
Not that one. I have performed in Toronto, but the Wednesday Addams one is probably actually going to happen. I'm performing there at the beginning of May. So pretty much, like, right after Shock Stock, I go home, I get ready to go and perform at Cherry Cola's Simple Sunday. So that's another cool thing that's happening. I just have to revamp the whole routine. It's been a while since I've done it, so...
So if our listeners want to see more of you, where can they get you on Facebook?
Yeah, I have my Instagram, StarletDrazen, at Instagram.com, and then I have my Facebook, so StarletDrazen. It's spelled like StarLott, like Charlotte with an ST instead of a CH. If anybody's looking me up, it's pretty easy to do it that way, you know? So, yeah, that's awesome. Pretty much it.
Thank you so much.
No problem. That was really fun. Thanks.
We're here at Shock Sock, and I've interviewed Tony Todd, I've interviewed Giovanni Lombardi-Radis, I've interviewed other people, but the biggest celebrity of them all is here right now, the one, the only, Toxic Avenger. Got anything to say to our listeners, Toxic?
Yeah, all I've got to say is it sucks that they're not here, because they're missing out on all the fun here at Shock Stock. This is personally my second year in a row here, and I love it. I can't get enough of this place. The people, the town. I absolutely love London. It's awesome. I wish I could retire here, but, you know, the people of Trumbullville need me, so I can only come here for a week every time.
Well, I was going to say, who's taking care of New Jersey while you're here?
Sarge Kabukiman.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's right, he is absent today. Where is Kabukiman?
Right. Well, he's floating around Jersey and New York, keeping things safe for everybody, you know. I got the week off, so I cover for him, he covers for me. We get it done, you know. We work good together.
Awesome. Well, you got your mop, you got your tutu.
Yep, yep.
You're all...
Oh, I'm always decked out. You're decked out. It's part of the uniform.
And right, if there's any nefarious crime, evildoers in the vicinity?
I've seen some human body parts for sale, yeah. But I've looked into it. Everything seems to be on the up and up so far.
Everything's
so,
kosher, yeah.
Kosher
good,
so
yeah.
far. I haven't checked the food truck. That's my next check to see, make sure everything's running smoothly. But,
awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. Pretty good so far. I'm loving it.
So what are you looking forward to for the rest of the week at Toxie?
Getting right ripped, actually. This is basically my vacation, so I'm just going to have an awesome time with all the late partying and meeting all the fans and just having a grand old time.
I'm shocked. Syntoxy, I thought you were you're straight edge.
Well, no, it is the weekend. It's my vacation
it's your time
right?
Off,
so
yeah.
I come up here to Canada. You got to come to Canada, enjoy the Canadian beer.
That's right, man.
You know, have a good time.
Don't worry, man. I'll have a drink with you.
Absolutely. You better. Like, up at the penthouse party this weekend. I hear it's going to be pretty awesome.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, everybody is. That's really, you know, that's why I come here for free.
Well, thanks a lot, Toxie.
Absolutely, no problem.
It's been a pleasure. So we're talking now with Jesse Lee, the star of Killer Cleavage from Outer Space.
Yep.
And The Walking Dead, a hardcore parody.
Yes, I'm not the star of that, but I do play a zombie.
Yeah.
That has sex with Daryl. A threesome. A zombie threesome.
Awesome. So, I mean, I was just saying, I love Killer Cleavage from Outer Space. I love Killer Clowns from Outer Space. You're saying there's no clowns in the movie.
There's no clowns. That's why it's Killer Cleavage, because it's all, like, huge tits. So every woman, every girl in the movie has huge boobs. Especially myself and Sheridan Love.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Are you familiar with the original Killer Clowns?
I haven't watched it in about 20 years.
Okay.
But I used to love that movie. So when Joanna told me that she's making Killer Cleavage movie, I was like, yes, so excited. So, yeah. I love it when she puts me in like movies that have like really clever titles. So.
And I have to say, I mean, when I introduced myself to you, I said, I'm not familiar with your work.
But you will be.
But I will be. There's a lot more empowering. So what is it like working with somebody who is a female?
Well, most I mean, I work mostly for Burning Angel, but most of the directors I've worked for are female. So yeah, I think the only time I've ever worked for a director who wasn't male was for Evil Angel and Naughty America. But like Wicked, Stormy Daniels, which is it's a really funny movie that was in Aquarius, and then Joanna's just, I don't know, I really love, I don't know, because I feel like women know what looks hot better than like men when it comes to directing porn. So I feel like females are more creative and funny. That's how I feel.
So how are you enjoying time at Shop Stop so far?
I like it. It's fun.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I love Canada, so...
Have you been up here before?
I'm originally from Buffalo, New York, so
really?
It's a few hours
so
south of here.
So we're basically like brothers and sisters. I mean,
I'm from southern Ontario.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love Buffalo.
I do too. Yeah. Well, I love Canada more, so.
What's that?
I love Canada more.
Do you really?
Yeah, I love Canada. So when Joanna told me that I'm going to be here, and I was like, oh my god, I get paid, I get a flight booked for Canada, I'm so excited.
Well, Canada's glad to have you here, and our listeners are glad to hear from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, so we've got Kelly here from Blood in the Snow, film festival, and which I guess you'll tell us about its mandate and its genesis, and how it came about, and what, you know.
We're in our fourth year. We started the festival in 2012 with a mandate to highlight emerging Canadian horror talent. We usually show 9 programs every year, 8 features and 15 shorts is usually about the... It varies from year to year, but that's not that. We have it over one weekend in Toronto. This year will be November 27th to the 29th at the Carlton Cinemas. It's our third year there. And we started in 2012. I used to run an event called Fright Nights at this theater called The Projection Booth, and I was just showing a feature and a short every month, and then suddenly I just had one month where all these films had been submitted to me that didn't have a Toronto home for a premiere, and so I thought I'd make it into, first it was just going to be like a weekend event, and then I realized that, you know, we needed a full film festival. So in a very short order, we created this film festival just really from nothing. And it took off. We got so much press coverage. MTV came out, like Star, everyone. Like it got a lot of coverage. We had some really great turns. We had 2 sold-out screenings that first year. And so we realized we had something going. And then we expanded our team. We moved it to the Carlton. We have over 25 people that help run the festival, and we have a whole vendor village, just much like they have here at Shockstock, so it's a whole community effort. And what's great is that they're all premieres and kind of that, all brand new filmmakers, so you're getting to see stuff that you can't see anywhere else.
Right. And I mean, sorry, Chris.
Oh, I was going to say, so how's it curated? How do you decide what goes in and what...
We have a programming team of 5 people like that. We usually do our submissions through Film Freeway online, one of the major sites to submit films, and we watch every single film. We, you know, like that, every single submission comes through, we have a really great diverse team of programmers that just have, you know, everything from just film fans to people that are film writers and do everything in the film and horror community. Mm-hmm. We will just discuss the films and what you try. I'll tell you, last year was really, really tough. Mm-hmm. We had some really, really tough choices right down to the wire, because there is a lot of real, just because you didn't get into the festival, I tell people, it doesn't mean you had a bad film.
Right.
We just simply couldn't find a spot for it. I mean, there's only so many slots and there's so many films that get made, and you're trying to, you know, get a diverse slot of different types of films and just how it would pair out. Just, you want kind of a nice flow so that people with a festival pass will get like a really nice mix of different kinds of films over the weekend.
So what's the ratio between, let's say, number of submissions versus slots filled?
We don't have as many submissions as other festivals because we only accept Canadian films,
exactly,
kind of like that too. So the ratio, your ratio, if you're a Canadian filmmaker and like that too, is going to be a lot higher than it will be for other festivals like Fantasia and Toronto Dark for that reason. Like that. But our ratio, I would say about 1 in 10 chance, probably a good ratio like that. So you're good if you made a good quality film, but it's also, but I could have programmed an entire weekend films that didn't get in, and everyone would go, wow, that was a great festival. Like, it really could, you know, really is. And I know that's small consolation for the ones who don't get in.
Right.
But also, too, sometimes we'll do, too, just, like, point them in the direction of, like, other events and things mm-hmm. like that that might be able to, might, they might be able to play and stuff like that. And we just found, just over in general, that having the premiere status really does help the hype of the festival and makes them know that they're seeing something that they can't see anywhere else. And it's so competitive, we have to kind of create that rule.
Yeah, to that end, is it still sort of burgeoning, or do you, is it a worry that you sort of cannibalize yourselves with Toronto After Dark and TIFF Midnight Madness and all the other stuff that you're, I guess, up against too, right? Is there only...
So. Yeah, but they only program so many. I mean, usually Midnight Madness only plays maybe one, maybe two films that are Canadian for features. Toronto After Dark does play quite a few Canadian shorts. All the shorts are out there before the features are that. But there's a lot more shorts. There's tons. There's plenty, plenty of shorts to pick from. And I think last year they generally played about three or four Canadian features. And interestingly, we've had very little. I think we only lost one film last year that we were seriously considering, kind of on the shorts program that they end up picking like that. And you think that we'd be fighting over a lot more, but I think our style is just a little different. I mean, I'm really good friends with Adam Lopez and like that. But I think their style, we can kind of usually kind of know what kind of films that they're going to play, versus and we can frankly, because we're playing a smaller theater, we can take a bit more chances where there's a bit more. They're playing a pretty large Cineplex cinema. For theirs like that, so there's a little bit more demands to make sure that it's going to be crowd-friendly films that they can play that too. We can take a little bit more of a risk on a few films that that normally wouldn't play at a Cinebox.
So, any previews of what we could look forward to seeing this year? You don't have to say titles, but what sorts of films?
No, actually, I gotta admit, I'm behind on my viewing. The other programs have been pretty excited about a couple of titles that come with that. What I think is interesting is like what the geography always changes about where we're getting films. Like we got a lot of films from Quebec last year, and then this year it's all in Vancouver.
Okay.
Vancouver has just been just blowing up. It's just I couldn't believe, I think half our submissions have been from BC. So that's kind of interesting with like that too. But it also makes sense because two of the higher profile films that we played last year, Black Mountainside and Bloody Knuckles, both came from Vancouver.
Right.
And then the year before that, we played Evangeline. So I think we've had some pretty big titles play the last 2 years, kind of thing like that, too. That's really got the Vancouver scene kind of excited about it.
Cool. Do you have any particular favorites over the past 4 years?
I get that question every single year. It's like, which one of your kids is your favorite?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I like that too. I don't have favorites, but I always like the ones I get excited about the most are the ones that are kind of the underdog films. I mean, there's certain films that have played our festival that we know are going to get good crowds. I mean, we played Ejecta last year, and you know we knew that was going to be, they were pretty high profile in Berkshire County. It sold out in 24 hours. It just did really well. So we knew those were going to be that. But then there's kind of like the wild card ones, and one of the ones was a film called Heinous Acts. And actually, the filmmakers are here today at Shockstock, and they were kind of like they were just had like their premiere at Sunday at 2 o'clock, and in the pack in the place, like it was just like really, it was this really cool little anthology film, and it was just, we were so excited. We didn't have it was their world premiere actually, so that was fun. I always like to see kind of like those more underdog films that get in to kind of like see like a, you know, like get an audience.
Well, it's interesting because I mean our mandate with our site and our podcast is to sort of champion films that otherwise might not be championed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And to give filmmakers who you know don't have like you know the big huge budgets and the studio distribution deals to give these films a fair chance.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I mean, would you say that's the mandate behind Blood in the Snow? Is
oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, because what we do too is we try and create like a total package for them. Like we're expanding. One thing we are going to do this year is expand our seminars. We did a seminar on distribution, like that, selling your film in the Cannes film market last year.
Oh, wow!
And then we're looking at maybe doing about three more seminars this year because it's a very filmmaker focused festival. I mean, we definitely have a big public audience, but we have a lot of other filmmakers checking in. Other filmmakers at the festival, that's a big component of it. So it's very much a filmmaker friendly, so we're kind of focusing on that. And we also do a lot, my background is very much in marketing and media and stuff, so we have, Kirk Havilland and I, we really look after getting a lot of media for that. I think we had over 55 press hits last year for the press. That was pretty good at that. And so we'll have like a whole press day, like red carpet, where people will do interviews like this, like your show, and for print, and for online. And then that really, basically the idea is it's supposed to give like a launch pad for them for doing the other thing. Because obviously the ultimate goal for them is to get distribution. And I think, and for 2012, they've got every single feature that Play has distribution now. I believe one from 2013 is still up for sale, and I think two from last year are left.
That's so amazing, because even Tiffany I. Manis doesn't have that track record.
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, some of them have had, in all fairness, a lot of them had distro before, right. Like comic dot too. Like, there was one called Kingdom Come that was actually going to come out on DVD like a couple weeks later, and they were able to do like just a one-time theatrical for it before it did that. So there was like that, but a lot of them have sold. Actually, Black Swan Distribution here has picked up a lot of the titles, like Disco Path.
We love Disco Path.
And that was their best picture win from 2013. Uh-huh. That was a really great. We were really excited when we got that title. And so it's really great just to kind of like to see those filmmakers make other films too. Right. Just like that's the thing too. It's just kind of like. Yeah. And I've known actually one thing I've heard too is I've heard about actors and directors and different filmmakers meeting up. I know for a fact films that have gotten made because they met each other at that festival.
Excellent.
And just going to the bars and chit-chatting after and seeing each other's stuff. And go, hey, we should work together on a project. And that's always exciting to see, too, with cultivating that.
It's good stuff.
And I guess for more, where can they check out your stuff?
Bloodandthesnow.ca. Cool. And you can see us, search for us on Facebook. Bits Film Fest is our Twitter handle, like that, and you'll find all the information on that. And tickets are on sale now for festival passes. Uh-huh. Not the individual tickets, but the festival. And I should mention, too, we have a, I'm not sure where this is going to air, but we have a Bits preview screening, a highlight screening of our Best Picture and Best Short from last year, Blade Knuckles and Greater Than, that's playing May 7th at the Carlton. I like that, too. And we'll have some more news and information about what's coming up for BITS 2015 at that screening.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to checking out Blend the Snow.
Yeah, we'll be there for sure.
We'll be there.
Yeah, great.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks,
guys.
I'm sitting here with Jeremy Rain, famous for Last House on the Left. She played Sadie. Now, I was just sitting here hearing you tell a few stories, which are very interesting. The first one is about your kids. You say your kids despise Last House on the Left?
I think they were shocked. They found it when they were fairly young. I didn't know their father had a copy of it because we had a deal when we met that he would never see it.
This is Richard Dreyfuss.
Right. Yeah. And obviously he had a copy, and they found it, and they did watch it. Sure, they were horrified. They didn't know that about me.
Wow. And you said something else about Richard's movie habits, which I found quite interesting. If you're willing to share with our listeners?
I just think he liked porn a lot.
He liked pornography.
He liked to buy it. Mm-hmm. And I would throw it out on a daily basis. He would bring it in, I would throw it out. And our housekeeper would go sell it down in Watts. And she made a lot of money on the corner selling it.
So you'd throw it out and he'd replenish your collection?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a constant. Yeah.
Well, that is a scoop. Richard Dreyfuss is a porn addict.
He did a movie called Inserts.
Right, right, with Jessica Harper.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. As fast as he bought it, I threw it out. So, but I recycled it.
Oh, well, that's good. So, Last House on the Left. So, how did you get that role? Did you audition?
Fred Lincoln, who I knew as Fred Furna, worked on an answering service. And back then, nobody had answering machines. You had to call your answering service to see if he had any auditions.
Yep.
And I knew Fred's very distinctive voice through the phone. And he said, I've got an audition for you. I want you to go meet Wes Craven and John Cunningham. And you're supposed to be in your 40s. And I was 22. And it's like, what the hell? I could, you know, when you're an actress and you're starving, you can do anything.
Right.
Jump off a cliff? Of course I could jump off a cliff. Be 40? Of course. So I went, and I don't know how, but I convinced them that I could be 40. But as you notice, I was supposed to be Junior's mother, but that becomes a little... They never really make that clear, because I don't look 40 in the movie.
No, you don't. Definitely.
No. So you're never really sure who the mother of Junior is. Right. It was supposed to be me. That's how I got it. Oh, and also I was killing Susan Atkins every night in a play in New York.
Okay.
So they came and saw me. And something was written about me that I was a study in violence. They said to watch Jeremy Rayne killing Susan Atkins, or Susan Sharon Tate every night is a study in violence. So I was Susan Atkins killing Sharon Tate.
And this was a play about the...
Yes, it was called 22 Years, the Rockumentary.
Wow.
And it was pretty scary.
Mm-hmm.
Then, talk about a crazy life I've led. I lived with John Savage for years, and we moved to live in Beverly Hills at his manager's house, who was away in Italy. And John did not tell me that that was the house that Sharon Tate was murdered in. So I lived there for 3 months, not knowing, thinking we lived in the greatest house in the world. Then one night he told me about our house.
Shit.
You have to understand that even before the murders, a couple months before, I met Charles Manson, Tex Watson. I was hitchhiking because my feet hurt and I couldn't walk back on Hollywood Boulevard to my great aunt's house. They picked me up. I thought they were nice guys.
I mean, he was a charmer.
He was very charming. He was from West Virginia, from Sissonville, West Virginia. I was from Charleston, which is right next door. I thought he was a nice guy. So talk about a bad judge of character.
Well, it wasn't just you, the Beach Boys.
Squeaky
Frog.
Yes. And it was Doris Day's son, Terry Melcher, who they thought Terry Melcher was going to be at that house when they went to kill people. They didn't go there to kill Sharon Tate.
Yep.
They did not know who those people were that were there. Very sad.
Yeah. So when you found out you were actually living in the Tate house, I mean, how did you feel about
it? Then it became haunted for me.
Yeah.
We stayed there another year, but I was terrified that anyone who saw a ghost got fired. Like, we had a housekeeper who said the bushes stood up and bowed. She was fired. I was so frightened of the living room. John and I, when Rudy Altobelli, the manager, moved back into the main house, John and I moved into the guest house. I was even more frightened in the guest house. Jimmy Woods, the actor, came over one night to dinner and was so afraid that he went home, called us and said, "I cannot come in that place."
Wow. I mean, they must have painted over the walls.
No. Nothing was changed.
Wow.
Nothing was changed. And one night, I complained to Rudy Altobelli that there was a zebra rug that was rolled up in the guest house that just gave me the creeps.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I don't know why. Sharon's body was found on it." He said, "I had the bloodstains cut out." He goes, "You can roll it up and put it on her grave if you want." Yeah, the humor was
unbelievable.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
So one night, Jimmy Woods was in the car, in the driveway, he wouldn't come in, and he yells. I was walking into the house to get something in the main house, and Jimmy Woods yells, "They're here! They're here!" I flew into the house, dove under the dining room table, into the corner, cowering. You don't realize how afraid you are.
Yeah.
And there's a second person in you always thinking, "What would I do?"
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then Thanksgiving.
Yep.
We cooked a turkey. Couldn't find a knife to carve the turkey. Rudy Altobelli said, "Well, some people broke into my house and they killed people with my knives, and the DA wouldn't give them back." She's like, "Oh."
Now, I mean, knowing that, I mean, you didn't know at first that this was the murder house, but I mean, you know, sort of this cult of infamy sort of built around Charles Manson, and you know, he almost became, I hate to say, for lack of a better term, a folk hero.
Yeah, in a weird, horrible way.
Were people coming around, like, you know, to see that?
All the time. It's funny that you asked that. Every Friday night, or every full moon, and I'd be home alone in the house, they would ring from the gate, and they'd go, "Sharon?"
Oh.
I don't know. But also, they creeped up the hill.
Right.
And I learned what to do, because Rudy always left the front door open for the dogs, so they could come and go. Great Danes that he had. I would open the door, and I'd yell at the people, maybe 30 people.
Wow.
I'd yell, first I'd go, Rudy, John, call the police. Go, Rudy and John weren't there. I'd always make it look like I wasn't alone.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then I'd say, give me your licenses. And they did. They would obey me. They'd hand me, and one was a cop. I'm like, why are you here? And they said they're thrill seekers. I mean, they couldn't help themselves. A lot of people were drawn to 10050 CLA Drive. We changed the address to 10025. That didn't scare anybody. That house is now bulldozed. The land is all... They regraded it all. Mm-hmm. They've changed it. You won't find that house now.
Well, last I heard Nine Inch Nails were recording. They recorded The Downward Spiral, one of their Nine Inch Nails. Yeah, are you familiar with the group?
Yeah.
Yeah, they recorded an album, and Trent Reznor lived in the house as he was recording.
Oh,
and
God.
he...
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no problem.
No. I'd love to get an autograph.
So, Jeremy, I don't want to take up too much of your time because you're greeting your fans, and they seem very excited to see you ever so graciously.
Oh!
I kill you.
Got it?
I kill you.
Awesome.
I piss on your grave.
Sorry, so I was going to say, I didn't want to take up too much of your time because you're greeting your fans, and I see you're very gracious. The fans are very happy to see you. But before I go, let's talk about David Hess. We're sitting here with an autographed picture of David Hess, and you said that you're sort of here representing him in spirit.
Well, he's my friend,
right.
And I miss him so much, and I miss Freddie, too. I mean, the three of us bonded during this movie and
right.
stayed friends our whole lives, so... And I rescue dogs, and David was very, very helpful with that. He got really into...
Animal rescue?
Yeah, he really did. He really cared a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how the biggest baddies on screen are the nicest people in real life.
No, it's absolutely true. Absolutely true. The baddies are actually softies.
Exactly.
It's so much fun to play a baddie. I would not want to play the victim. It's much more fun to be a bad guy.
To be the baddie, yeah.
Then when you see the movie, it's like, oh, what did I do? I'm so sorry.
And then when your kids see the movie, they're like, well, is that my mother?
Mom! Mom is crazy!
Yep. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Yeah.
Amazing stories. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a great time here at Shockstock. And
thank you.
All the best.
Thanks.
Heard us talk about him on the Really Awful Movies podcast many a time. The one, the only, the ultimate, Lewis from Suspect Video.
Wow, what an introduction.
How's it going, Lewis?
Good. How's it going, Jeff?
I'm doing fine. How's Shock Stock so far?
It's always fun, you know, like it you know, business wise the first day is a little bit slow, you know,
okay.
Like but we kinda ease into the weekend, you know. But I'm having a fun time. You seem to be having a fun time.
I'm having a great time.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, as I said, I mean, we talk about Suspect Video often on the Really Awful Movies podcast. We say it's probably the best repository for just about anything in the city.
Oh, thank you.
And, you know, we couldn't do without you. So tell us about the store. Tell us what led you to...
Made it.
You know,
to opening it?
To open the store, and yep.
The short story is that I went to film school at Ryerson with the person who became my partner in the store. His name was Merrill, and we finished technically the film program, and we'd written scripts and we wanted to film these scripts, and as everyone knows, the easiest way to get money is through relatives and things like this, but chances of them recouping that amount of money was very minimal. And so we decided that it would be much easier and much nicer in terms of familial relationships to get money from family to open a store.
Okay.
And it would be a video store.
Not the mafia. Family,
no,
no. But family.
No, family.
Yeah, okay.
And and so we figured, you know, like we obviously like movies a lot. And so we decided on opening a video store. And the idea was that... that it would give us a lot of in with distributors and things like this, and that we can parlay that into raising money for these films. And that didn't really happen because I guess technically we were thinking it was going to be a short-term kind of thing for whatever reason, but it didn't end up being that way. You know, we opened it, and we had really specific ideas as to what we wanted to carry. And basically it was, my attitude was that pretty much anything was valid. You know, like, I didn't want to be a censor in any capacity other than, you know, censoring out stupidity and middle-of-the-road stuff. That's the only thing that we wouldn't really cater to, but with everything else, it was all fair game. And initially, it didn't look like it was going to take off because we didn't do very well. But then there was a turning point for whatever reason, and it started to get quite popular, and people started to discover it, and people were coming in. And those were the glory days of the video store. Mm-hmm. And which was awesome because everything would rent, and like literally everything that we got, with very few exceptions, would rent really well, which would allow us to just get anything, you know, because we knew that if we got something that was so strangely esoteric, that the interest would be so minimal in this, that it would be offset by people renting all this other stuff, you know, and that's how it all started. And you know, like it's difficult to talk about it being inside of it,
right?
As opposed to other people's impression, because it's other people's impression. It's you know, I don't share it because I'm not, you know, I'm not outside of the store. I'm inside the store.
Well, Scott, I mean, when you opened in '92, right? I mean, that was
'91. Yeah.
I mean, that was sort of like, I guess maybe the heyday of the Blockbuster, Rogers, Blockbuster hegemony. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And so here you are. We have this independent video store, specializing in sort of esoteric movies of all sorts, horror, B movies, pornography, what you name it, right?
Yeah.
Did you feel any pressure opening up an independent store when, like, Blockbuster was such a ubiquitous presence back then?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like something like two months previous to our opening date, there was a Video 99 that opened like half a block away, and we thought, that's not great. But it ended up being better, I think, for us, because we were almost the diametric opposite of that,
right?
And so we could almost like play off of that. But it was a weird time because, you know, this was obviously pre-internet, and it was much more difficult to find uncut things in Ontario. There was much stronger and more stringent censorship going on, and everything had to be approved, and lots of stuff was cut. Like, as you know.
Right.
So
I hate that stuff. But I mean,
oh, yeah.
I don't know if you feel comfortable about this going on the podcast, but you told me a few funny stories about border runs.
I used to do that all the time.
Yeah.
I went to, we would order things from magazines. A lot of times it was like, you know, like gray market type stuff, because that was the only way to get some uncut stuff. But and each time we would order it, you know, you cross your fingers and hope that it's not stopped by the border. And so for quite a few years, I used to go to conventions in the United States and bring stuff over. And I would bring things over pretty clandestinely. I don't know if I should really be saying this stuff, but we used to have like a lot of little tricks on doing it.
Yeah, I was going to say you're like the Al Capone of, you know,
of
the video market. Yeah.
There were things like... I would bring stuff up. If it was particularly, let's say... on the borderland, I would do things like I would cut the tape in the VHS cassette, because I would think that, okay, if I'm stopped, they'll just look at it and they won't bother to re-splice it to watch what is in it. I would, you know, if I was confronted, I'd just say, oh, shit, it's a damaged product, right? And just little things like that to try and facilitate bringing things over, you know, taking labels off, or, you know, replacing the covers, just all kinds of stuff, you know, mailing it. There'd be all manner of different ways, you know, like, and then the internet started and the whole idea of censorship kind of became, in the early days of the internet, which was, you know, in order to acquire anything was quite expensive. And so I rallied against censorship because at that time it became the realm of the affluent. You know, if you were rich enough, you could circumvent any amount of censorship by you know, having high speed at that time, you know, like service and all of this stuff. So it just became ridiculous. And now anyone can apply or whatever. I mean, you can get photos of anything or videos of anything somewhat, you know. Like, there's still a lot of stuff. Like, that being said, there's still tons and tons of stuff that you just can't get online. And people don't seem to believe that, but...
I mean, that's the whole thing, too. I mean, because, okay, I wanted to say, I mean, the irony is that we're talking about Blockbuster, right? I mean,
yeah.
That being such a, you know, hegemonic monopoly, I mean, you and a few handful of stores in the Toronto area, you're, like, on the last man standing. I mean, they're all gone, and you still remain, right? Now, of course, the landscape of video retailing is completely different now because of the internet.
Yeah.
And, I mean, a lot of people... They don't know what the value is of having a good video store where they get like a good physical copy, because I mean, you go on Netflix, I mean, you go on the internet, I mean, there's so much shit you just cannot get. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you can't get, I mean, classics. Forget about, like, you know, esoteric stuff or whatever, but I mean, you know, I think the only AFI Top 100 movie is on Netflix is like Raging Bull.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a great movie, but I mean, there's like 99 others, you know what I mean?
That's true.
And people seem to think that, okay, I don't need physical anymore because I have the internet, and that anything I want, I can get off the internet. That's not true.
It's not, no. And there's, I'm not a Luddite or anything like this, but I find that, you know, the easy access to a lot of things, and like I said before, there's tons and tons of stuff that you can't get. But the easy access to the stuff that you can get, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you can acquire these things really quickly and easily, but on the other hand, the very act of the ease by which you are streaming this,
it devalues
it to such a degree that, you know, like when you go out and you buy something, whether it's any kind of media, it could be movies, it could be music or what have you, when you go out and buy it or if you rent it, you've invested time and effort, and so you will sit down and you will consume it from beginning to end, chances are, you know. But when all you're doing is streaming it, it's so easy to not give things the proper chance that they should have in most cases. You know, like, it's so easy to just kind of, you know, let's say you're on Netflix and just picking a movie, watching the first 5 or 10 minutes, you don't like it, so on to the next movie. Now, that first 5 or 10 minutes could be not reflective of later the movie, or you might just not be in the mood or what have you. But you could be really losing out on an experience that could be, you know, like life-altering almost, or you know, at the least, you're losing out on experiencing a really interesting movie that might need a little more attention and a little more
time to see. Yeah. I mean, compared to music, I mean, like, there will never be another, let's say, Pink Floyd the Wall, because, I mean, nobody's making cohesive holes anymore. It's all about the single, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So
there's been lots of albums where, you know, I'll buy it, you know, I've heard that it's good, I buy it, I take it home, I listen to it once through, I think, this is not for me.
I know.
And then, you know, because you bought it,
you paid for it
a while ago,
you
put it back on,
exactly.
You kind of listen, well, these tunes are okay. Then you put it back on, it's like, you know, what the hell was I missing? You know, like, this is great.
Like,
you know?
Captain Beefheart, Crowdmaster Pepper Club. That was
Yeah, fun. Yeah, yeah.
I recently bought that on vinyl. I had to, like, listen to it 8 times before I actually start to like it. Now I fucking love it.
Yeah.
Know?
But if you're, like, subscribing to a streaming service, you know, you'd recognize the title, you play it, and think, well, no, it's not for me.
Yeah, hear one song, and you're like, ah,
that's it.
On to the next. Right, okay. Talking about movies, I mean, back in my early days of becoming a horror fan and a fanatic, I mean, I started, like, really discovering the Italians, like the Fulcis and the Argentos, and I mean, these are films I could not get at my local Blockbuster.
Oh, yeah.
So here I am, you know, hunting these films down by whatever means, and that's how I came across your store.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I'm like, holy shit, this guy's renting, like, Suspiria. I mean, I've only read about this movie, and I'm like, but, I mean, at the time I was living in the suburbs, right? So the whole act of going downtown, renting a movie, having to search for that movie, taking it home, just made it so much more. It was almost like finding like the Holy Grail. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That whole search. It's like, and it made it so much more precious. And to actually, when I put it in, the experience was so much more rich. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I guess picture now, if I just, you know, went on like a torrent site, it's Suspiria, it's like, okay, whatever.
That's
as
true.
Opposed to being a life changing experience, it was. You know?
Yeah. Well, I've always been a fan. Like, I've always been a collector. I've collected, you know, cards, comics, movies, and it's, you know, the hunt is something that a lot of people...
And not just the hunt, the dig, you know?
The dig,
the
like going into a place that just seems like utter chaos, and just, you know, spending hours, like, literally hours, mm-hmm. just digging through things and trying to find things and, you know, uncovering... You know, the bizarrest whatever medium that you're going for,
yep.
and just thinking, what the hell is this? You know, and it was always a great experience. You know, and in the early days of video, there were warehouses like that, and like when we first opened, VHS was quite expensive, and so we couldn't really afford new VHS, and there was. Warehouses where stores would go and buy used VHS, then they were from, you know, larger distributors or video chains and things, and you would never guess what you're gonna come up with, and it was really exciting. Like, we got some awesome titles, and again, this was at a time when we would just try anything. We, you know, my partner would pick up a title and just say, what the hell is this? And we'd look at it and say, we gotta get it, you know. And we got so much stuff.
I know people have seen it too, like people have said, but nobody's been able to find like
the uncut version.
So yeah, I'm curious if this is it or not.
I'll check and see. Yeah.
So there's Lewis doing some business. Anyways, Lewis, before we sign off, I wanted to ask you one. So here we are with Dog Stock, we're in London, Ontario.
Yeah.
Now you have your own horror festival, Horrorama.
We do, yeah.
And we went to the inaugural one last year, which was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Cannot wait for Horrorama.
Oh, thank you.
You know, 2015. So,
yeah.
What can you tell our listeners about Horrorama?
Like the impetus as to why we started it, or
in
general?
You can talk about, I mean, that too. I mean, we know you want to create like a US-style horror convention.
Yeah, I just wanted a horror convention. That's all I wanted. And the first year kind of proved to me that a lot of other people wanted that too. And so we're going for a bigger venue, more vendors, more guests.
Hopefully. Great guests announced already.
Yeah. We like to milk it, you know, like a lot of conventions will just kind of like throw all their
right.
our guests out there. But I like to kind of like, you know, create more of an interactive kind of like who's it gonna be next, you know, kind of almost huckster-ish sort of vibe. But I think it's really interesting and fun to just, you know, tease it out and do this. But plus, it gives us a lot more leeway in terms of. Getting people, you know, like you know, we don't have to put all our eggs in one basket,
right.
So, you know, we can, it'll be a continual sort of negotiation between us and people, and some people become available like later as opposed to earlier.
Yep.
It's gonna be great. We're gonna have hopefully a really cool screening with somebody. We're not quite sure what screening with who. I mean, we could have any number of screenings depending on who we decide to go with. We'll have some great vendors. I'm hoping to get some people that have never done Toronto shows vendor wise.
Awesome.
We've announced six so far, and one that we haven't announced yet, but we put it on our postcard right now. It's Steve Niles, the comic writer. It's going to be great. It's October 17th and 18th. Yeah. Which is, you know, I think the kickoff to Halloween proper.
It's awesome.
And
scheduling.
Yeah, it's good venue, and you're going to be there.
I'll be there.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. I wouldn't miss it for the world.
So any of your fans will get the chance to meet you if they come down. Right?
And you as well.
Yeah.
Our fans.
Yeah.
All right, Lewis, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot.
So this is the end of day 3 of Shockstock. We're just wrapping things up.
Yeah. Dispatch here from your weary traveling.
Yep, sitting in the train station right about now, waiting for our train to...
There's like one... there
that's
we go.
Our train.
It's makes for riveting radio right here.
Waiting for it to bring it back to our downtown headquarters, Toronto. But to paraphrase Ozzy Osbourne, Mama, we're coming home. So, Chris, closing thoughts on Shock Stock.
I was just going to say, there's like one train track here. It's like this sort of a, you know, outpost. Some sort of a trading post kind of vibe to it. It's a fairly sizable city, 300,000 people, and there's the one track leading out of here. And, anyway. Yeah, closing thoughts.
We're right across from the Call the Office, which was a really excellent watering hole that we were at last night for the official Shock Stock after party.
Yeah, I guess the notorious sort of, you know, kind of dumpy club that's been, you know, featured a lot of really amazing acts.
Yep.
You would never think looking at it from the exterior.
The Specials, Frank Black, Didi Ramone, Marky Ramone.
Yeah.
A lot of Canadian bands.
And that was the site of, I guess, the rap party, which featured a, I guess, a nondescript metal band and Monsters of Schlock.
Monsters of Schlock.
Is it pejorative to say that they're a freak show?
Yeah, they're no, not at all.
Do they accept that moniker?
I think they would accept it and embrace it.
Yep. Okay, well, let's charitably call them a sideshow act.
They're a sideshow act, yep.
And that featured fish hooks
through the eyeballs.
Through the eyeballs.
Picking up cinder blocks with said fish hooks.
Here's the train. There's some mouse traps affixed to tongues.
Yep.
So that was a pretty apropos way of
people being tased. Yeah. Needles.
The same guy, it should be said, who had the mouse trap on his tongue was tased.
Yep.
So it wasn't bad enough, and he apparently has the Guinness World Record for most mouse traps affixed to his tongue, which is somebody.
They're a good looking. Well, they are a good looking bunch of guys. I say they're a good bunch of guys.
Friendly guys.
Horbox and Pepper.
Yeah.
And we're going to hopefully interview them for a future podcast.
Yeah.
We also had the crowning of Miss Chalk Sock, but we're not going to talk about that.
No.
No, I don't think so. We'll just let that go.
Yeah.
And then the main act performed, and I can't remember Permanence. I can't remember. It's actually the band of James and Jake, the guys from Vagrancy Cinema or Vagrancy Films, that put on this great weekend.
Yeah.
So I want to thank James and Jake. They were for having us and allowing us to experience this wicked event, Shock Stock. And
yeah.
Look forward to coming back next year.
Definitely. And shout out to some of the vendors as well, Vinegar Syndrome from Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Yep.
A couple of really cool guys, and we're looking forward to reviewing some of their stuff in the future. The Troma. Forget about them. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, exceptional guys. Toxie was there.
We interviewed him. You heard his interview. Black Fawn. Of course, Lewis, Suspect Video.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris from Fangoria.
Yep, for sure. Chris from Fangoria. And of course, thanks to Tony Todd and Giovanni Lombardi Ruiz and Jeremy Rain and all the other guests that allowed us to interview them. So, and Blood and Snow as well. But thanks to them.
Yeah.
Festival
obviously featuring Canadiana, best of Canadian horror.
So I think we say
we bid you adieu because we're feeling less than chipper from due to last night's festivities.
Exactly.
So we'll definitely talk to you soon.
We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Take care.